This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And of course, this time of year, we're talking about elections, and that has been a regular theme on our Main Street shows for the past few weeks at any rate. We've been talking with all of the candidates for statewide races, and today I am pleased to have in the studio here in Fargo, Joshua Boshi. He is a candidate for North Dakota Secretary of State. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. Always a pleasure, Doug.
We should point out that you are currently a representative in the state legislature, and you represent District 44 in North Fargo, so why are you going after this job? You got one.
Well, you know, I got in this race, Doug, primarily as a small business owner, but also a legislator who has experience working on the Industry, Business, and Labor Committee and really looking at some of the inefficiencies in the Secretary of State's office, the lack of modernization, the opportunities that we have to move business forward in North Dakota and the role that the Secretary of State's office can play in that.
So, but you would be foregoing the rest of your term in the legislature?
That is correct, yeah. If I'm fortunate and the voters decide to send me to Bismarck, the district officers in my district and leaders will select someone to replace me.
Well, let's talk about the background that you bring to the role. You're currently in real estate, right?
Correct, yep. I'm over at Hatch Realty. I serve as a real estate agent but also our sales manager.
And give us a little bit of your educational background.
Sure. You know, I grew up in Minot, attended Bishop Ryan High School there, proud Ryan Lion, came to Fargo. Became a Bison and got my undergrad in actually political science, which is ironic enough because I was not politically involved. I didn't know anything about political ideology till well after I graduated college. But then I continued working at the university and was fortunate to get my master's in education.
And so your qualifications for the job of Secretary of State as you would determine them?
Certainly. You know, first and foremost, being a small business owner and a small business leader, engaging with the real estate community, the chambers of commerce throughout the state, both as a business owner, but also as a legislator on, like I said, the Industry, Business, and Labor Committee. So I feel that I bring not only the real lived experience of what our businesses are facing in North Dakota and how they engage with commerce, but also a policy hat in knowing how to work with the legislature to make sure that we are passing proactive policy versus reactive policy to the Secretary of State's office.
You mentioned some of the duties of the Secretary of State's office. We talk a fair amount about voting and elections. That's one of the duties. But this business interface with the state is also critically important. Expand on that for our listeners.
Absolutely. You know, the Secretary of State's office is really an administrative function. There's a lot of different entities of state government that engage with the office and specifically stakeholders out in the public. So businesses, nonprofits, and family farms register and annually renew through the office. But also contractors get licensed through the office. Notaries get their authorization through the office. It's the office where Mixed Martial Arts and Boxing Commission is held. So I want to be your next boxing commissioner. And then, of course, what most folks recognize is with elections. And I think on day one, what I learned when I visited with my first auditor out there was that Secretary of State, while plays an important role in administering elections, it's more of just a hub for that election information to come to. It's really our auditors that are managing our elections and the poll workers that are the front door of democracy in each of our communities that make it work so great.
Well, you're talking about an office that, you know, sounds like a bureaucracy. So people often disparage bureaucracies. How would you make this bureaucracy the Josh Boshi bureaucracy?
Well, first and foremost, like I said, we need to modernize the office. We need to get some of these basic functions online. As a small business owner, you can't register your business online in North Dakota. You can in South Dakota, you can in Montana, and you can in Minnesota. You can renew in one day. In North Dakota, right now, on average, it's 24 days to renew your business because it's all through a paper mail process. So we're gonna modernize the office, but then also serve as the front door of business to North Dakota and work with the other state agencies and regulatory boards to bring all the systems together. Right now, again, as a small business owner, you interact with anywhere from 4 to 7 state agencies, regulatory boards, or commissions. Each one of those entities has their own registration system, their own database. None of those systems are speaking to each other. So I've proposed what we call the ND Hub, which would be a one-stop shop. Instead of logging into 7 websites, you log into 1 website and making compliance with government easy and making sure government can get out of the way.
Well, you know that government has turf battles occasionally. So you're talking about agencies and offices and boards and what's to keep them from being pretty protective about what they're doing right now.
Well, and that's where bureaucracy falls in, right? So let's remove the bureaucracy and let's go to the stakeholders. Let's go to the businesses and the professionals who are impacted by those licensing boards, by those state agencies, and work with them. And that's really where the idea of ND Hub came from. It came from a roundtable discussion I had with business leaders in Rugby, North Dakota, beginning of June. So sitting there, and these small business owners were talking about how they were frustrated because many of them did their paperwork after the kids had gone to bed. And, you know, there's not someone they can call to say, is this the right paperwork or not? If they had an online system where everything was talking to each other, they didn't have to re-enter data one quarter to the next or one year to the next and just do a couple clicks, pay their bill, and then be done.
Well, this issue of modernizing, especially the online presence of the state, has been talked about for a few years at least. Al Jager, the incumbent, has talked about it, and his office has reportedly been working on upgrading the system. And the governor of the state of North Dakota is, of course, a well-known software guy. So a year from now, if you were successful, what would it look like to go online at the Secretary of State's office?
Well, you know, I certainly agree. You know, while the current Secretary of State has talked about these issues, there's not been any action. This has been 13 years in the making of an online system that one failure after the other, as soon as, you know, as far back as 3 weeks ago when the new product was supposed to launch, and as business owners, we're still sitting here without an online system. I would certainly work in partnership with the governor, who has this vision of bringing technology under one roof, making sure that state agencies are working to improve opportunities for small businesses and North Dakotans, but also working with the legislature. So a year from now, I really see that we would have gone into the legislative session and worked with the legislature to start building the infrastructure to create not only a one-stop shop, but also a seamless experience that, again, nonprofits, family farmers, and small businesses have when engaging with government.
And this would be all phases of government for North Dakota, not just the Secretary of State's office?
Well, we certainly would start with the Secretary of State's office and then start working with those other regulatory boards and agencies. So, you know, you can't steer a big ship and change direction that quickly. But, again, visiting with business owners, nonprofit leaders, community leaders throughout the state as I've campaigned the last 8 months, they're on board. So I think if we give them the direction, say, let's go talk to your legislators, let's find a solution together, we'll start seeing the groundwork get laid pretty quickly.
Joshua Boshi is candidate for North Dakota Secretary of State. He's running under the Democratic NPL endorsement. And you can find out more at josh4nd.com. I went up there and I discovered these three core issues that you're campaigning on. Modernize the office, we've been talking about a bit. How about securing voting rights for all eligible voters? What are you getting at there?
Well, primarily, you know, voter ID is the law of the land. Majority of North Dakotans have an ID. The challenge is the infrastructure we have in terms of how do people update their ID or get a new ID, especially in rural North Dakota. I was down in Lemoore the other week, and folks were talking about how they use the DMV in Oaks. The DMV in Oaks is open less than 5 hours a month. And so if I'm somebody whose ID has expired, if I don't get there on that one day, you know, so if my work A allows me to or I have transportation to get there, then I might have to go to the Valley City office. Well, the Valley City office is open just a few more times each month. Those of us here in Fargo, Minot, Bismarck, Grand Forks, we're fine. We have one or two DMVs that you might have to sit at for a while to get your ID, your new ID updated, but you can do it during regular business hours. So it's looking at how do we meet the needs of rural North Dakota? How do we work with our tribal communities to make sure their IDs are in compliance? How do we work with the university system to make sure when students are here, they're A, educated on how and when they can vote, but also what they need to do to be in compliance?
Well, you have some experience with that. You work for Minnesota State University Moorhead in sort of student activities, if you will. So we've got in the Fargo-Moorhead area, and of course most of them are on the North Dakota side, tens of thousands of students. What are you telling them about their voting rights?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, we're letting them know that once you've lived here 30 days, the law says you can vote. So whether you're a student or a new employee or someone who crossed over, you know, from either Minnesota or came from the south down in Texas near an oil field worker.
Can you use your dorm address as your address then?
You can, but you'd have to update your ID to reflect that.
So the important thing is that student's ID, if it has an address that is not at the campus, they can't vote there.
Correct. Yep. So they would have to go to the DMV and either get a new ID if they weren't a North Dakota resident, Or if they're a North Dakotan who moved from, let's say, Minot or Wimbledon, they would need to go on the DOT website and update their address on the back end.
It does seem to be an extra hurdle for a student to go through because obviously you're living someplace else for 4 years. You're under that government, that municipal government, and that's where you are. And yet, unlike most voters, you have to go to the trouble of getting another ID that says, well, now I'm here.
I think you're exactly right, Doug. It creates an additional barrier, but it's not an unachievable barrier. And that's where education becomes an issue. And currently, the Secretary of State's office isn't working with groups like the North Dakota Student Association, North Dakota University System, or many other nonprofits throughout the state to say, this is how we educate people to vote. I think about for instance, I'm a realtor, right? So I think about at a real estate transaction, I help buyers who are buying a new house. Why don't we work with the title companies so there's a little slip of paper that, among all the other papers you're signing, says this is how you update your ID so you can vote from your new address. How do we work with the infrastructure that's out there, the way that people engage in their lives every day, to make it easy to vote and as long as you're eligible?
All right. There's another issue that you have up there, these three major issues, and that's cybersecurity. Of course, we're all pretty aware of the vulnerability of our online systems to hacking. The Russian hacking into the 2016 election is fresh in our minds. What's your concern about North Dakota's cybersecurity, the integrity of our online experience?
No, that's a great question, and I hear it a lot when I'm out campaigning. First of all, North Dakota was one of the 21 states that was probed in the 2016 election. The Department of Homeland Security has confirmed that. And because we don't plug our machines into the wall or into the internet, we're pretty well off. And we have a paper backup. And so the fact that you run a paper ballot through a machine, that ballot gets stored and recorded in case there are concerns about that infrastructure. I think the bigger issue we have to look at is our database, our voter database, which is called the Central Voter File. That is rolled over from the Department of Motor Vehicles. It's updated by auditors and the Secretary of State's office. It is a database that's online and accessible. So how are we making sure that's secure? How do we make sure that the right voters are in there? How do we make sure that people who aren't eligible to vote aren't in there? And so it's more being proactive and thinking through those things, again, with our county auditors, with state agencies, legislators, and the public to think forward, think these things through before they actually happen to us.
There might be another issue here, though, with cybersecurity in terms of, social media. That is trolls basically picking a state like North Dakota with a very contentious and nationally recognized Senate race and maybe really working Facebook and Twitter and all that to move votes.
Absolutely. And that's where I think the power of a voter education campaign that is absent from the current Secretary of State. If people are seeing on Facebook that you can text in to vote or you can call this number to cast your vote in the absence of official information coming from the Secretary of State's office through their county auditors and other stakeholders, people might believe that. And so people who intended to vote might vote in the wrong way, but their vote was never counted then. So to battle some of that social media issues, some of the trolling that we saw in the 2016 election and continue to see in 2018, it's a matter of how do we partner and go to where people are at. If people are on social media getting their information, how is the Secretary of State's office using that medium to get the appropriate information to voters?
How are you getting your message to voters? I mean, as I mentioned, this one race that is, pretty much getting all the attention in the state. How are you getting your message to voters?
I really, when I announced back in the end of January, I knew that this was going to be an uphill battle. The current incumbent has been there for a long time. Many people have voted for him several times. So I knew I had to get out on the road. And I'm just about to break 30,000 miles on my car. I've been everywhere from Wahpeton to Williston, everything in between. Having conversations with voters, with business and community leaders, trying to understand how can the state be a good partner to them, not only in the Secretary of State's office, but also the legislature and other state agencies. And it's been an extremely rewarding experience to understand what is the heartbeat of Rugby, North Dakota? What makes Valley City tick? What are the goals and aspirations of the folks up in Bottineau? And spending a day there, not just flying by, doing a handshake, a meet and greet at the Senex store and flying out, but spending time getting to know people in their own community.
Well, and getting voters activated.
Absolutely. Educating them on the process as well.
North Dakota Commerce Commissioner Jay Shuler offered his resignation yesterday. It was accepted by Governor Burgum. He said it followed an inappropriate email he sent to staff, and I think that email was referring to the ongoing intense discussion in Washington about a new Supreme Court nominee. What's your take on what happened?
Well, I only know what's been reported in the paper, and of course we received a letter from the governor as a legislator saying that he had accepted the resignation. You know, I think it is a lesson learned in those of us that are in public service, whether we're hired, appointed, or elected, that there are certain standards we have to follow. And, you know, I respect the integrity of Commissioner Shuler in stepping down on his own accord and recognizing that information he may have shared in private business isn't appropriate when you're on the taxpayer dollar as well. I think back as a former public employee, you always knew anything could end up on the front page of the local newspaper because of public information. So you learned what do you communicate and what can't you communicate.
Are there debates scheduled between you and incumbent Al Jaeger?
You know, the only opportunity we had to have a real public conversation was on Prairie Public. And huge shout out to Prairie Public for offering that medium because there really are no other opportunities other than we've been in the same location at the same event to meet people one-on-one. There hasn't been a public dialogue.
And when you look at the office of Secretary of State, who are you working for?
Well, I think first and foremost the voters, being the chief election officer of the state, but even more so small businesses, nonprofits, those entities that are more engaged with the office than others. How do we create those efficiencies so that, again, compliance with government regulation or government processes is easy and we can get out of the way? So I look forward to the opportunity. I think a common question I get from folks is, well, why do you want to go from being able to make policy as a legislator to someone who has to follow policy and act it? And really for me, it's I see a broken system right now and I see an opportunity that I can fix it. I can get people on board and collaborate with stakeholders. And who knows, 4-8 years down the road, be done and go on to something new.
And, of course, you'll be out on the road campaigning. I guess in about a week or so, you'll be in Wishick for Sauerkraut Day.
Looking forward to it.
Okay. Joshua Boshi is a candidate for North Dakota Secretary of State. Coming up, the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor.
What scares us most about death? What happens to our bodies after we pass away? Mortician and funeral industry rabble-rouser Caitlin Doty answers all your most morbid questions. Caitlin puts the fun in funeral, and you can meet her at the Game Changer Ideas Festival on October 13th. More information can be found online at GameChangerND.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. This year's induction ceremony for the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor was held on September 6th. Three new inductees were honored in the hall, which is located in the State Museum at the North Dakota Heritage Center. One of the new honorees is the 1941-42 Elbow Woods Warriors basketball team. The Warriors were the first Native American team to win the North Dakota State Basketball Championship. Although they lost the actual championship game by 1 point, they were awarded the championship 60 years later after the winning team forfeited over a rules violation. Makoche Studio of Bismarck prepared video profiles for all the Hall of Honor members, and today we share the Warriors' story with the audio from their profile. In order, we will hear from Mark Fox, Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Tribal Chair, whose father Isaac played on the team, Marilyn Hudson, tribal historian and a member of the last graduating class at Elbow Woods, Minot native Dale Brown, who became famous as the basketball coach at Louisiana State University. Brown is in the North Dakota Sports Hall of Fame. And we'll also hear from Delvin Rabbithead Sr., son of player John Rabbithead. And finally, Arnold Grady, son of team forward Harry Grady.
I grew up hearing every day conversations at my own home when they'd stop in to visit my father. I heard them repeatedly talk about Elbow Woods and what happened. And they would always reference back and say, we never did get that trophy and that title and that recognition, did we? And that stood that way for 60 years.
Elbow Woods was a community located in sort of the bend of the Missouri River. And of course, it was heavily wooded. So there you have Elbow Woods, which was sort of the hub of the community. By and large, you know, the people of Elba Woods and those surrounding communities were pretty much self-reliant. You know, some people have compared it to Camelot. It was not, certainly not Camelot, but it was probably pretty close.
Elba Woods Warriors, I can remember seeing them play. I saw them play in the state championship. They were talented. They just had it. They were just natural. You don't teach what they had. You don't coach it.
And of course, what we're all so proud of is what we call the Elba Woods lore, the Elba Woods legacy, is all these amazing athletes that have stemmed from there.
We have a long line of athletes. Not only that, they're good athletes and students. They're good students, too.
They didn't have a budget for sports in Elba Woods. The gymnasium was smaller than the regulation size, and so they had to learn to play regulation size basketball on a very small court that the coach later on wrote, the free throw circle intersected with the center jump, you know, it was that small.
Well, my dad, they called him Johnny off the radiator rabbit head because the gym they played in at the time was pretty small, actually, a Cracker Jack box. And he used to, his famous shot was he'd go up and jump off the radiator in the gym there and shoot the ball in midair in one motion. So they called him Johnny off the radiator.
Elba Woods played a different style of basketball. A new coach, a new system, new players, in effect, these Indian boys.
A young man named Leon Wall, who came there to teach, actually, science and math. He was told, well, not only are you going to teach, you're going to be the athletics director. And he said, wait a minute, you know.
They called them the Dazzling Indian Quint. And they were doing something different from other teams. And as each game went on, season and throughout the season, the crowd started getting bigger and bigger.
They were that type of basketball team. And when they went to state, I read that there was 1,000 people all cheering for the Warriors.
And a newspaper started reporting that these Indian boys, this Dazzling Indian Quint, were doing something different from everybody else, passing behind the back, fancy dribbling, you know, it's almost like Harlem Globetrotters.
Natural talent, tremendous ball handlers, unselfish. I can remember it was really a unit you saw.
Players would fall down from the opposing teams. They would pick them up, shake their hand, and get on with the game.
They had this uncanny ability to identify with the crowd, and the crowd began to root for them. You know, hey, look, here's this group of Indian boys from a place called Elba Woods.
They were having fun out on that court, and everybody wanted to see them. Now, everywhere they went, they packed the gyms from that point forward all the way to the state championship.
And I remember looking at the program, the state Class B championship, when they had passed names on there. Then I looked at 42, and they had no champion. They had a question mark. And I said, my dad was on there, and they talked about it. But they never got no recognition until 60 years later. But it was kind of like very sad because all those Native American men, our relatives, they all passed away.
That was something very difficult for our people to accept because there was a phenomenal season.
They really deserved the recognition of being state champs after all the controversy that they faced and had to go through throughout the years. So that was very well deserved.
A phenomenal beginning of something, Elba Woods lore, as we call it, this fascinating time in our history that needs to be remembered, that needs to be acknowledged.
The Native American Hall of Honor recognizes Native Americans who have gone above and beyond in representing their tribe and culture. The Hall of Honor is a partnership of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission, the State Historical Society of North Dakota, the State Historical Society Foundation, and United Tribes Technical College. Our thanks to David Swenson at Makoche Studio of Bismarck. You can see all of the Hall of Honor profiles at vimeo.com/Makoche. That's M-A-K-O-C-H-E, Makoche. Coming up on Main Street, children's author Anastasia Higginbotham First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The man charged in a fatal drive-by shooting in Fargo last month was arrested in a U.S. Marshal sting that targeted gang members. 44-year-old Miguel Cooley was one of 41 people arrested during Operation Damage Control. Acting U.S. Marshal Dan Orr says Operation Damage Control is designed to destabilize gang networks nationwide.
We have focused on identifying through intelligence-led policing, identifying people who are known to be gang members or associates of gangs and violent offenders in our community. And we focus this operation on trying to locate those individuals and arrest those who are wanted on warrants charging them with violent crimes.
Cooley is accused of shooting and killing 20-year-old Gabriel Perez on September 23rd in the parking lot of the Fargo McDonald's on Main Avenue. Orr says he has no knowledge that Cooley is a gang member. Cass County voters will be asked to approve a half-cent countywide sales tax in the November general election to pay for a new emergency radio system for law enforcement and first responders. The tax would be in place for 1 year. The existing system is on its last legs. At the end of the year, the manufacturer will no longer provide support, and spare parts to the repair system are hard to find because of the system's age. The estimated cost of the new radio system is $15 million to $17 million. County Commissioner Chad Peterson says there's only one other option.
If the one-year sales tax doesn't pass on the ballot, it'll go to a property tax funding mechanism. The mechanism will be about a five-year term, plus or minus, depending upon how bids come in, but that's really our two options for funding the emergency radio.
Peterson, local law enforcement, and first responders say the new system is not a want, but a critical need for public safety. The legislature has discussed a new statewide system for several sessions, but has failed to appropriate the funding. Cass County decided to proceed on its own. The county radio system will be tied into the new Minnesota Armor radio system, which will allow communication across state lines, the only North Dakota county to do that. County commissioners approved putting the sales tax measure to a vote in August. And the Jamestown Arts Center will once again be host to the Worldwide Manhattan Short Film Festival this weekend. The 21st annual festival spans over 300 cities and six continents for residents to judge the work of the next generation of filmmakers from around the world. The final nine films are screened simultaneously across the world, with the Best Film and Best Actor awards determined by ballots cast by the audiences in each participating venue.
I don't know if people really realize, and I didn't know that I really realized, how big this is. I mean, this is huge. This is just not in the United States. This is worldwide.
Jamestown Arts Center Education Coordinator Myra Olson says audience participation is important for the festival. Each short film is automatically Oscar qualified, with all finalists hailing from Austria, Canada, Germany, Hungary, Kosovo, New Zealand, USA, and two coming from the United Kingdom. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Hi, I'm Matt Olean. This midterm election is one of the most closely watched in North Dakota history, with local, regional, and national implications. None more so than the race for U.S. Senate, which could help maintain a Republican majority or tip the scales in favor of Democrats. Join me and the PBS NewsHour's Judy Woodruff Friday, October 5th at 7 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Mountain on TV, radio, and online for a one-hour debate in the race for U.S. Senate with the candidates, the incumbent Democrat Heidi Heitkamp and U.S. Representative Republican Kevin Kramer. That's Friday, October 5th at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public's TV, radio, and online streams and apps. I hope you'll join us.
Prairie Public 2018 debates are made possible in part by AARP North Dakota.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Anastasia Higginbotham writes and illustrates books for children, and she's not afraid to tackle difficult subjects. Her previous books help parents talk to their kids about death, divorce, and sex. Her latest book is called Not My Idea, A Book About Whiteness. Higginbotham wrote it in light of news reports about shootings of unarmed black men and boys. Ashley Thornburg caught up with her at a recent book signing event.
Anastasia, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for asking me.
Can I have you start with reading the first few pages of this book?
When grown-ups try to hide scary things from kids. Oh, no, not again. What? Mom, what not again? It's usually because they're scared, too. Who is that with their hands up? Why is that policeman screaming at him? Bang, 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 bang! They want to bury the truth, You don't need to worry about this, says Mom. You're safe. Understand? And the child's thoughts say, no.
Not a lot of kids' books ask that question of a kid, do you understand?
Well, no, and not a lot of kids' books show the moments when the parent and the child are not exactly communicating very well with each other.
In the introduction that your publisher gave you, Jennifer Baumgartner from Daughter Press, she called this a radical children's book, and that really struck me because it's a book where we are telling the truth. So just to think of telling the truth to kids as a radical concept, how does that sit with you?
It sits, well, you know, the alternative does not sit well with me. I didn't like being lied to as a child. I often knew I was being lied to, that things were being covered over or made pretty for me or made softer for me or hidden from me. I've never appreciated it, and so out of respect and love for children, I make a point to tell them the truth. And as an artist and as an author, I hold myself to a standard where telling the truth, you know, it doesn't come immediately. I have to dig down even to get to it myself, to understand what the truth is and to find a way to say it that a child can understand and feel respected and possibly feel very challenged.
Well, it is not an easy topic to talk about, even amongst adults. How did you even go about starting to write a book about racism, especially for white children?
As difficult it is as it may seem to talk about it, and as daunting as that may feel if you haven't talked about it yet, I find that the experience of not talking about it, not addressing it, knowing that racism is happening, knowing that people are experiencing that being targeted, being over-policed, being kept in prisons and sentenced longer sentences, harsher sentences, knowing that this is going on for my fellow human beings is intolerable to me. So talking about race is a relief. Talking about my whiteness, talking about my role in perpetuating white supremacy and making connections with other people so that we can understand it, understand our role, and be aware and bring the racism that exists in us, because we just breathe it in. The culture conditions us into it. But the more conscious we can be, the more conscious our choices are. And then we can actually begin to undo, in some ways, what should never have been done.
Why did you want to call the book Not My Idea, a book about whiteness?
I wanted to acknowledge the defensiveness that comes up in us when we are called upon to look at our own whiteness and look at our role in perpetuating racism. When it wasn't our idea, my own children are born into a system that is violent and unjust. It's built into everything. Even though it was not their idea, it is their responsibility, just as it is my responsibility, to unravel and untangle and reckon with the systems that are favoring us economically, socially, all of the things that affect my daily experience of being a white person moving through the world, being a person who is seen as white, even though these categories are fake, right? I'm not white like a piece of paper white, and just as black people are not black like a piece of paper that's black. And yet we're working with these categories because even though it's fake and it's a structure that's human-made, a human-made hierarchy that is used to profit, the consequences of it are real. So even though this idea that whites are superior is false, the consequences are real and deadly, and it has passed down generationally. It is accepted passively. And so by calling it Not My Idea, I start from that place of defensiveness, that slightly defensiveness, but also just, it's not my idea. Okay. So what is your idea? That's what I want to know. And I want children to be able to have that moment of being incredulous about racism. It's a terrible idea. And if you explain racism to a child, how it works, who it favors, who it targets, who it harms and in what particular ways and for how long, it is a horrendous idea. It's not an idea that any child would ever come up with on their own, like, hey, I have a great system for us. I also want to acknowledge a child's sense of, like, who the hell came up with this? You know, so that's not my idea. And then, yes, get as quickly as possible to, okay, good, what is your idea?
We have a 400-year legacy of racist policies, racist attitude, and violence in this country. Why did you set this book in the present?
I set this book in the present because the American narrative, it's willing to accept that the civil rights movement happened, right? But it's frozen in these black and white images, these bits of film and little snippets of speeches, like the nice parts of the speeches and the parts that make us feel good about ourselves, make us feel good about Martin Luther King, who was hated at the time by so many people. And so we've got this idea of an acceptable civil rights movement that has been frozen in the past as if it got done. It didn't get done. And so many of the people from that time were assassinated. I mean, the leaders of that time were brutalized and murdered. And the reason I said it in the current time frame is because it never stopped. It never stopped. The narrative pretended that it got done. And look at all that progress that African Americans have made. You know, have you ever heard Chris Rock talk about this idea of, like, he hates that it's framed as African Americans have progressed. He's like, we didn't progress. That, like, assumes that it was never our problem. This is the nicest that white people have ever been to us. I appreciate that so much because it's not the African American struggle. It's white people who are struggling with our own inferiority complex.
The imagery in the book is very powerful, and you do collage work and drawing to make the illustrations that go along with this. And there's one section where people are watching this family speak out on TV after a shooting, mm-hmm. and the mom and dad want to change the channel or are complaining mm-hmm. about something that really is not the point of the issue, like they're blocking mm-hmm. the streets. And the two kids, so presumably the sibling of the child who was shot and then the white child in the center of mm-hmm. the book, are looking at each other. Mm-hmm. Just talk about the power, that knowledge that kids have and that ability to connect with other kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's happening in that scene, I used an image from the Alton Sterling press conference after Alton Sterling, a father, was murdered in Baton Rouge, and his child was standing next to his mother while she gave a statement, and he broke down and he hid behind his shirt because he was, you know, in addition to the trauma of his father having been murdered, now it's in public. He has to grieve in public. I wanted to depict that moment of a child so overwhelmed, no privacy to grieve, and someone who has been so wronged, and the child, the white child who's watching the child on TV, really tuned in to that child. And I think that's just the child's humanity is intact. That is a child who's just feeling empathy, just seeing another child in pain and wondering what happened to him. What did they do? What did he lose?
This book, and again, it's called Not My Idea, a book about whiteness. Other books in the Ordinary Terrible Things series are Let's Talk About Sex, Grandma, Divorce is the Worst, and Death is Stupid. And I noticed that those first three books, all published by Feminist Press, this one has a new publisher in mm-hmm. Daughter Press. Usually, if someone has an established relationship mm-hmm. with a publisher, that book's going to get picked up by a publisher. What happened?
Well, what happened there was Jennifer was my publisher and my champion for the series at the Feminist Press. And when she left the press, there wasn't anyone immediately taking over the position when she left. There just was a slight gap in time. It wasn't the right time for the book about whiteness to come out through the feminist press. And really, in another aspect of it is that Jennifer and I knew we still wanted to work together. I really didn't want to lose her leadership on this series. And the way that she understands what I'm working with, the way that she trusts me, and the way that she edits me to get the best work and to get the story to be told with as much impact as it could possibly have. The Feminist Press was experiencing a transition in leadership, and I was going to do the book no matter what. And Jennifer was willing to continue to work with me, even if it meant, well, I'm going to start my own press then. Really grateful we could keep it going.
Why do you kneel when you read this book in public?
I kneel because it feels right. I am very moved by what Colin Kaepernick. I don't care about sports at all, and I don't like football at all, and I don't like the NFL. That's true. Okay, all those things are true. But I am very moved by the players. Not only Colin Kaepernick, but he was the first, but any of the players who take a knee during the national anthem. It is a knee for justice. It is a knee for honoring the ancestors. I mean, I see him taking a knee for so many generations of violence and strife and unnecessary, unendurable, unbearable pain. And there should be acknowledgement. The fact that he takes a knee, if that draws everybody's attention, that's wonderful. It should. If he says, I'm taking a knee because of police brutality, I want to take a knee with him. I want to take responsibility for that. And I kneel to read the book out of humility. I want to be as close as possible to the ground of America's making, because that's where the truth is buried, that's where the treasures are buried, and that's where the bodies are buried. I want to get low and close to what's real in this country. And kneeling next to a cardboard picture of Colin Kaepernick that I made allows me something physical to do, to align with Black liberation completely with my body and my soul.
In communication, there's the message sent and then there's the message received, and sometimes those don't align. And you shared this almost heartbreaking story of your son's reaction to the book where he said, okay, so we're the wrong color, or we're the bad color, but we're good people, and you and your kids are white, and this book is not saying that white kids are bad kids. Mm-hmm. This book is talking about how you can stand up to a bad system, but how do you make sure that kids don't internalize that the wrong way?
I don't have control over how it's received exactly. My son said, we're the bad color, but we're not bad people, right? And I said, well, that depends on what we do with what we know. And I really believe that. It's not... you're not good just because you showed up. And being good is not the point. And being told that we're good is not the point. I don't feel good about what's happening in this country or what has ever happened in this country and been made excuses for or condoned in some way or the just hidden from the public sight. So, you know, there's all this, like, white children are taught to look away, and black and brown children are taught to, like, look sharp, pay attention, think about the signals you're sending off, you know? And it's just, it's not ever been fair. So the idea of good, there's a moment in the book where the child says, I don't feel good. And they are talking about, like, nausea and grief that comes with the trauma of confronting a traumatic past. The child has been reading history, and I find reading history extremely traumatic, because if you engage with the truth of it at all, it's very, very upsetting. We need each other to be able to talk about these things, and so the child saying, I don't feel good, and it's a feeling in their body, but it's also about, I don't feel good about this. I don't feel good in this. How could I possibly feel good in this? I think that feeling is one to follow. I don't feel good about this. It's because it's rotten. That doesn't mean that America is rotten. It doesn't mean that white people are rotten, but it does. When there's something rotten, you have to address it. If there's something stinking in your refrigerator and growing and decaying, you have to address it. If there's an injury in your family, if there's a member of your family that is hurting and injured and asking to be believed about the injury, just to be believed, and you refuse to believe it, and you look away and you say, that's not really happening to you. I mean, that's not how you treat a family member who you care for. And if you continue to have denial toward that family member, the family is ripped apart. The family can never be. And the injury cannot heal. So the only way is to look at the injury together. There is so much grace and riches and surviving and thriving and spiritual well-being and nurturing that is happening in the communities of black and brown people and black families and brown families. And white people have yet to do that with each other, be honest in our families, and be allies to one another in confronting racial justice and confronting our racialized experiences and confronting and taking on our responsibility as people who are part of a white supremacy, who are being favored by a white supremacy, who did not choose it but have a responsibility to address it.
The book ends with, your history's not all written yet. What do you want it to say? Where do you want children to go with this question?
Inward. I want them to take that question very much to heart and how they live their lives every day. It's an offering to be a child and have someone ask you, what do you want your history to be? It's a nice jumping off place for the first day of the rest of your life. It's an invitation to make choices and to be conscious about what your life is. And children can do that. They love to do that. Children love responsibility. They don't necessarily want to, like, sort the laundry and do the chores of the house, but, like, responsibility for being part of something that has meaning and purpose and is connected to justice and healing society, I think, you know, we're going to find a lot of children are into that.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you, too.
That was Anastasia Higginbotham, author and illustrator of the Ordinary Terrible Things series, talking about her latest book, Not My Idea, a book about whiteness. Other books include Divorce is the Worst, Death is Stupid, and Let's Talk About Sex, Grandma. You can get the books at AnastasiaHigginbotham.com and at some independent bookstores. Dakota Date Book is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Politics is the story we're all binging on, and we'll be the ones to decide how it comes out this November. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Join me each Monday through Thursday for a national conversation from WNYC about the issues that matter most to voters in every corner of the country. We'll hear from candidates, activists, and from you in our live news and call-in program, America on the Line.
NPR's new live call-in show, America on the Line, airs Monday through Thursday at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 2nd. North Dakota has a handful of counties that share a name with one of the state's towns. Cavalier, Golden Valley, Adams, McKenzie, Bowman, Botineau, Rolette, Hedinger, Pembina, and Mercer. The town of Mercer is a younger community in North Dakota, having sprung up along the Northern Pacific Railroad in 1905. It was named for William Henry Harrison Mercer. He was from Pennsylvania and came to the Painted Woods area along the Missouri River near present-day Washburn in 1869. He was also an early Burley County official, serving as a county commissioner and deputy sheriff. But that's enough about him. Mercer, North Dakota, is not in Mercer County. It's on the other side of the Missouri River in McLean County. About 250 people lived there at its peak in the 1930s and 40s. Today, maybe 100. Mercer had its start in the summer of 1905 as a 25-acre town site platted along a rail extension from Denhoff to Turtle Lake. Mercer's plat was a T-town in a grid pattern, with the tracks as the crossbar and Main Street running north from there. Buildings went up almost immediately. On this date in 1905, Mercer's post office was established. The town's grain elevators made quite a little trade center for farmers, though construction of Mercer's rail depot was delayed until 1907, since rail traffic hadn't met the required thresholds for freight and passengers. But Mercer still boomed as a little prairie town. A lumberyard was likely the first business. Families flocked to Mercer throughout those early years, and houses sprang up. The Mercer Telegram began recording the town's doings in both English and German. The two men who filed the town plat promoted lot sales in Mercer as the McLean County Townsite Company. In 1909, their names came to grace two streets in Mercer, Regan and Wing. And today, there are also the cities of Regan and Wing, though they're in Burley, the next county over. So go ahead, lay out a town, and get one named after you. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Today, China means power in the world, and China will win with Morocco.
China has plans to build a brand new city from scratch on Morocco's coast, but could logistics and politics stand in its way?
It's not a done deal until you actually see some cold, hard cash flowing across the border.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, our conversations with statewide candidates continue with David Thompson, the Democratic NPL-endorsed candidate for Attorney General. Thompson is seeking to unseat incumbent Wayne Stengel. And Robin Reynolds of Dakota Clay Works in Hebron is one of the attractions at this year's Knotstock at Minot State University. On Wednesday, we'll hear about her shop on the Old Red, Old Tin Trail and the famous clay in the Hebron area. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.